You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly look at the AL Central. I'm Anthony Kasterman. Thanks for tuning in. The second half of the 2016 season is underway, and the key question in the Central is whether the Cleveland Indians can hold on to their sizable edge. We'll talk to Jordan Bastian about that. We'll also get some early trade deadline rumblings from Jason Beck in Detroit, Scott Merkin in Chicago, Jeffrey Flanagan in Kansas City, and Twins broadcaster Corey Provis will join us for the latest from Minnesota, where a GM change is underway. Thanks for listening. Here we go. Corey, obviously a bombshell coming out of the Twins. I was going to say out of Minnesota, but it was actually physically out of Detroit this week with the news of Terry Ryan being dismissed, long-tenured executive in the Twins organization. And obviously, Corey, this is a very loyal organization. It has been for a very long time. So I think people were maybe shocked from that standpoint, not quite as shocked from the standpoint of the way the results have trended here, especially here in 2016. So just give me your overall thoughts on this shakeup.
Well, I'm with you. I think the word shocking and stunning, that came to mind yesterday when we got word of the news and of the decision to relieve Terry Ryan of his job. It's something that I would not have been surprised to see, Anthony, if it was after the season. But the timing of it especially caught, I think, everybody off guard. And what's amazing is that Terry knew about this a month ago. And if you kind of just trace back and how this whole thing went down, this decision was made a month ago that Terry was not going to be retained for 2017. And then Terry was informed of this in person about 2 weeks ago. And then he had time to process this, and then they kind of went for the All-Star break. And then Friday, before the Twins opened up the series against the Indians, Terry met with Jim Paulette and Dave St. Peter again. And then kind of Terry said, look, why wait? Let's just do it now. And then I interviewed Terry on Sunday. We did, and I'll do it with Rob now, kind of a Sunday GM show. And the fact that his poker face was amazing. And they never let any of this kind of leak. I never saw it. And it's kind of like I've been thinking about the movie The Sixth Sense a little bit today, is that you're stunned by the ending. And after you see it, you want to go back and, boy, watch the movie again. Did you miss anything? Were there any kind of secrets along the way that you kind of saw this coming? And that's kind of what I thought about today. Were there any red flags? And I can't really come up with any, and that's kind of an odd thing because news like this often leaks, but that wasn't the case with this huge decision that came down yesterday.
Yeah, and I guess knowing Terry Ryan, I'm not totally surprised to hear that he was able to maintain that poker face. The guy has that great demeanor about him. And just then before we get address the future, just your reflections on obviously you've had a lot of interactions with Ryan, and I know in my time, he's always been so accessible to those of us on the reporting side. He's there before every game if you want to get the latest news and notes, so to speak, or just get his thoughts on things, and almost has a Clint Eastwood-type delivery about him, very old school, and obviously he represents that old school scouting perspective, which is still so important in this game. But what were your reflections on working alongside him and getting to know him over the years?
Yeah, you used the word accessibility, Anthony. I think you nailed it there because I've worked with some other teams. I've been around some other GMs, and what Terry did is not the norm, that he would meet with writers, whether it be the Twins' own reporters or out-of-town reporters, what have you, every day, about a half hour before the game began. He would sit there, whether it was in spring training or during the regular season, he would sit there and just kind of fire away. And in my dealings with him, he would always tell me, hey, ask me anything you want. You may not get the answer that you're looking for, but ask me anything you want. And what more could you ask for? Obviously, I'm not going to have access to everything, but he was always open to the idea, hey, ask me anything, and I'll do my best to answer it to the best of my abilities without giving away maybe our game plan or even strategy. So that's all you could ask for. I think in my position as a broadcaster is accessibility. And to kind of be in the loop if things are happening and when things are happening, and you may not know the specifics of it. And that's always fair. And Terry was always fair about that. And I'll miss not just the baseball stuff, but he was an avid runner. And he would go out running every day, and I'd ask him about his routes and where he went. And he had a Sunday night tradition of always having pizza. He was big into thin crust. He hated deep dish Chicago pizza, hated that. So he'd always kind of loved it, you know, tell me about the pizza place he went to, whether it was at home with his family. His wife would make their own pizza, or if he was on the road on a Sunday, he was going to find pizza somewhere. So just kind of those conversations, I'll miss having those with Terry because it wasn't just always about baseball.
Well, as we look forward here, so Jim Polad said at the news conference announcing this move that Paul Molitor is safe no matter what for 2017. Obviously, that's an unusual situation where, you know, potentially a guy comes in from outside the organization as GM, has the manager in place. Sometimes people are able to make those marriages, those arranged marriages, if you will, work. Sometimes not so much. What are your thoughts on Molitor's future there?
You know, I've been reading a lot about that today, and a couple of the stories I read about that say, you know, are making the point that this may, you know, this may take some candidates out of the pool. I don't agree with that. I think the Twins' job is a very, very attractive job. It's been the Twins have been voted to have one of the top farm systems in the game the last few seasons. Now, some of these guys have not blossomed yet, like Byron Buxton, his name comes up a lot. His struggles are pretty much well documented. Sano still brings you all that raw power. I think we'll see Jose Berríos come back. Kepler's been a nice addition, a nice breakout performer this year. And there's still some more pitching that's going to be coming, especially at Double A right now. Guys like Cole Stewart and Tyler Jay and Steven Gonsalves and Felix Jorge. You know, so I think there is that element that makes this job attractive. I still think Target Field is attractive. The way of life in the Twin Cities is attractive. So I think this is still a very appealing job. And, you know, Paul had a great year last year in year one. He finished third in the American League Manager of the Year voting. And this year has been a disaster. And is this all on Paul's table? I don't think it's fair to say that because he can only work with what he had. That's why I think Terry was more of the fall guy than Paul was when this decision came down in recent weeks.
There are obviously some big names out there in the quote-unquote free agent market for GMs. We saw a situation in Toronto last year with Alex Anthopoulos. You know, they bring in Mark Shapiro as president. Alex Anthopoulos decides to leave after a banner year for Toronto. Ben Cherington, very well respected in the game. He was ousted in Boston last year when they had Dave Dombrowski. And you know, various other ways they can go about this. I'm just wondering, kind of big picture, your expectations as far as, A, the timetable, and, B, is this an opportunity for kind of start fresh, a new perspective, you know, more analytical approach? Or what are your expectations as far as the next step here?
Well, I'm not convinced, Anthony, that it's only going to be one guy one woman, for that matter. I don't think that it's only going to be they're going to hire one person for this job. It could go that route, but I'm not sold that that will be the case. And I think like the Cubs come to mind right now, just having this conversation where they have a president of baseball operations and Theo Epstein, then they have their GM and Jed Hoyer, and then they have an impressive talent pool after that. The Twins don't have a president of just baseball operations. Dave St. Peter is the president of the ball club overseeing baseball and business. But the Twins don't have that president of baseball operations. So who's to say that they can't go that route and hire numerous people to fill what Terry was doing, you know, on his own? So they may go that route. I wouldn't be shocked if they do. Because that seems to be a popular trend to go in the game today. I think they're going to be wide open with this. There are going to be some internal candidates that are going to be obviously interested in the position. Rob Anthony, the interim GM, certainly comes to mind. But Wayne Krivsky has some previous GM experience with the Reds. He was an assistant to Terry Ryan. Darren Johnson, the scouting director for the Twins. Mike Radcliffe, the vice president of player personnel for the Twins. I think he'll certainly throw his hat in the ring. But I think there will be plenty of external candidates who, going back to my previous answer, I think there will be plenty of external candidates who will show interest in this position because of what I defined earlier. And I don't think that the announcement that Paul is definitely going to be back in 2017 is going to scare any of the candidates away from pursuing this job.
For tuning in, I'm Anthony Kashvitz, and this is our weekly look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined, as I am each week, by Jeffrey Flanagan. Jeffrey, I got to tell you, at the All-Star game in San Diego last week, post-game, they bring in Terry Collins into the press interview room and to assess the loss. And then they bring in Ned Yost and Eric Hosmer in succession. I'm like, this certainly feels familiar. obviously, the Royals stepped up on that national stage, as they are prone to do. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of the second half, just your thoughts on how that All-Star game played out, with the Royals driving all the runs to the American League, Eric Hosmer is the MVP. Everything was coming up Royals again that night.
Yeah, I'm sure Collins is feeling like, well, here we go again. But I think it really it produced some good vibes for the first time in a long time with this organization. The fan base reacted very positively to that game, and the clubhouse was kind of jumping on Friday when they got back. There haven't been that many great fun moments for this team for the first half of the season, and yeah, certainly that provided one.
Yeah, absolutely. And another great moment coming up on Thursday, the Royals will visit the White House. I know it's the number one question on the lips of fans. Will Jeffrey Flanagan be in attendance?
I will be there covering it if I can get through Secret
Service.
There you
go. Well, that is a question. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. But obviously, great moment in the aftermath of the championship glow. Get to go shake hands with the Prez and all that entails. So it'll be a great moment for them. Good, nice. Not a bad way to spend an off day. But in the meantime, obviously things are not going particularly great, as you alluded to, in the actual games themselves here in 2016. Injuries are a huge part of that. As we record this, the Royals have dropped 7 of their last 10. And this is all, of course, coming at a time when teams are thinking about not always a big question like what direction do we go with the organization, but, you know, how much is this club worth adding to? Is it worth subtracting from at all? I don't think the Royals will get to that point, but certainly when you talk about mid-season additions, it's tough. The Royals are in a tough spot. They traded away 5 pitchers at last year's deadline, so they don't want to cut the farm system too much more. But there's certainly need on this club, again, given the injuries and the inconsistency in the rotation. What do you make of the July market as it pertains to the Royals?
Well, I think they're going to be somewhat active as much as they can be. You mentioned the haul that they had to give up last year to get Cueto and Zobrist, and it was substantial. There's not a ton of prospects right now to offer, but I think Dayton Moore and his staff will be pretty creative in trying to bolster this team right now, and it certainly needs something. I mean, you mentioned the 7 out of 10. There's just some things lacking right now. They don't have a number 5 starter, so to speak. Once again, this week they'll be probably going with Dylan Gee or Brian Flynn. Right field has been kind of an issue. Paul Orlando's numbers are way down in the last month and a half. They're just not getting any production there. Offensively, as a whole, they're just not really doing a whole lot, and it's that kind of inconsistency is showing up right now. And just like in Sunday's game, I was mentioning with some of the coaching staff that was a game, and they lost 4-2 on a walk-off homer off of Soria. That was a game a year ago that they would have found a way to win. And those types of games this year, they're kind of finding ways to lose. And it's just the difference maybe in the energy level, the makeup of this team right now. It's just things are not clicking. And I do think they'll be active. I don't think Dayton's going to throw up the white flag. He's way too competitive for that. I don't know what they can get with what's out there. You talk about a 5th starter, maybe it's a Matt Moore, Odorizzi, someone like that. But it depends on the price tag, of course. But 2 years ago at this time, they were 2 games under 500, and they made a strong surge toward that final wild card spot, and we know what happened after that. So keep that in mind, that this team's, not dead yet.
Merck, I know you just had an omelet, so you are ready for this podcast, and I think the White Sox offense needs some omelets in their system. They have 1 run scored since July 9th as we record this. It's been a, lackluster offensive attack in general the past couple seasons, but this has been a particularly futile stretch, and it's coming at an important stretch. This club looks to decide what it is in advance of the July trade deadline. What do you make of the offense right now, Mark?
I should add that I had an omelet and I got a haircut this week, so I'm really prepared for this week's podcast. But it's right. Yeah, it's interesting because, going into the Seattle series, they've been off offense. It's just terrible. They were shut out 3 straight games. They haven't scored in 40 of the last 41 innings going back to Atlanta before the break. And you look at the numbers, though, and the offense really hasn't been great all year. I mean, they were, I think, I wrote yesterday, but I think the stats, I think it's runs, home runs, OPS, and average. They're 13th across the board in the American League, and that's not good. And they haven't been very consistent over the last couple of years, and they need to hit. I mean, there's no question about it. They've gotten some good pitching. They've had some, you know, a few off starts there, too, but, I mean, Fields has turned in two tremendous starts back-to-back. I think 15 and two-thirds innings, three runs. Basically, three extra base hits got him. He gave him two home runs in Atlanta and then a triple to, you know, Escobar, and that was it. Miguel Gonzalez had a great start out of the break. Turner and Sale in that stretch, not as great. But, you know, they're wasting some opportunities. And the problem with the Sox right now is because of that 10 and 26 run after the 23 and 10 start, they just can't afford to go into any kind of prolonged funk. They can't afford a 2-8 stretch. They can't afford a 4-10 stretch because there's too many teams in front of them. And now you're starting to look at it and say, let's not even think about Boston or Cleveland because they're like 7-9 games up. But let's look at the wild card, the second wild card. Toronto's 5.5 up. Okay, that's pretty significant, especially when you don't play them again this year. But you look at Houston. I think Houston's like 4.5 up on them. And even Detroit's got 2.5 games. So now you're starting to talk about making up significant ground on more than one team. You know, it's one thing to be tied with Kansas City or a half game behind Kansas City, or I think you're tied with Seattle. So you don't even think about that, but just the teams ahead, you can't let them separate too far. You know, you always hear, Anthony, as you know, oh, we've only played 60 games, we've only played 45 games, we've only played 85 games. Well, it's past that time, but we've only played now. So they need to start putting something together. They need to start hitting and start hitting right away to and kind of getting the pitching and the hitting on the same pace. They haven't had that all year.
No, they haven't, and we've seen Rick Hahn and company make some moves. The James Shields acquisition was a big one, of course. Signed Justin Morneau midseason, and now he's with the big club. Do you think it's safe to say they are done in the buying market? Is what you see what you get with this particular roster, or do you think there's still opportunity to make a move, to add on to this club?
I think there's still opportunities to make a move. I think the moves that fans want might be a little far-fetched. In our midseason story, I suggest that they go after Carlos Gonzalez, because if you're really going to be in on it, if you're really going to push for the playoffs, whether it's that second wild card and you got to win one game just to get going, or you somehow, you know, with a lot of head-to-head games with Cleveland, you somehow jump Kansas City and Detroit and catch Cleveland, if you're going to go for it, you might as well do that. But the thing is, they just don't have, you know, the system has improved, there's no question about it, but there's not enough guys that they're willing to trade off the major league roster or the teams I think desperately want in the system to make such a huge move. I would think Spencer Adams is a guy who would hold some interest. He's still very young, but extremely talented. Right-handed pitcher, he's their third-rated prospect per MLB pipeline. I would think, you know, Avi Garcia just hasn't worked so far for them, and I'm not saying that he doesn't have the talent to make it work, but I just don't think it's going to happen in Chicago. It was kind of like a more accomplished level with Eric Johnson. I think Eric Johnson could be a good starter someday. It just wasn't going to happen with the White Sox. But if a team trades for Avi, you're trading on potential. You're not trading on any past results. So what do you get for potential? So I would think, in answer to your question, they're never shying away from making big moves, significant moves, but it's going to be tougher to pull off, not even financially, just finding the talent package. What I would be interested to see, I don't know what your opinion on this is, Anthony, but if they maybe made a move that involved a significant big league player that brought back a younger player they had control and still didn't diminish them too much in terms of this, you know, kind of borderline fight for the playoffs. For instance, you know, what is David Robert? David Robert's a great guy. He's done a nice job as closer, but what is he worth to a contending team when you have a guy like Nate Jones you could put in as a closer, even, you know, try Carson Fulmer in the later inning role too. So something of that nature. I'm not saying, you know, blow this team up and start trading Sale and Quintana and Frazier. I'm just saying that I wonder, you know, if they will look at doing both, you know, kind of adding but subtracting and adding at the same time.
That's interesting, Mark. I hadn't really thought of the Robertson angle. You know, his contract, which at the time I think it was, you know, maybe my lone beef with their offseason going into 2015 and turned out to be a good deal for them so far. You know, especially relative to the way other things have worked out. So
that's
a lot to chew on there.
He's closed in New York. He's played for a World Series champion in New York. So this is a guy who has the experience, you know. So I'm just saying, you know, if they believe, well, we're kind of in it, but we're not sure. And, you know, if we decimate the farm system and don't win, we're really in trouble then. So maybe we can look at this guy. He's been great for us. Maybe we can get something back for him. keep building and still give us a shot this year. It'll be interesting to see what path they choose, though.
You mentioned Fulmer. You know, he made his debut on Sunday, and the second time, of course, Tim Anderson being the first, where, you know, the White Sox, out of courage or out of desperation or some combination of the two.
Or courageous desperation.
dipped into the upper echelon in their farm system. What do you make of Fulmer and his role moving forward?
I think Fulmer is ready to go. He's like Tim Anderson. You know, he kind of forced the issue. He pitched well enough to get the call. And one of the things three actually, I keep adding up. Great kid. Really, you know, a personality that I think could really take over Chicago if he becomes a success. And I don't know if it's going to be long-term as a reliever or if this is going to be the Mark Burley, Chris Sale, Carlos Rodon path and have him start as a reliever and then eventually become part of the rotation, maybe even as soon as 17. Number two, he almost kind of embraced, if not relished, the struggles he had at the beginning of the year where he was walking a lot of guys, which is very uncommon for him because he said it proved to him, I talked to him right before the Futures game, and he said it proved to him that he could handle, you know, tough times and get through it and make the adjustments necessary. And three, one of the issues, the main issue he had was his delivery they thought was a little fast. They slowed him down a little bit in spring training. And I think he came hit by his own admission. He kind of overcompensated and slowed it down too much. So now if you look at him and look at old tapes, he's back to the delivery he had at Vanderbilt, and it works for him. Sometimes no change is the best change. He had a nice first game. I mean, Anthony, it's hard to top your first batter. You have a three-pitch strikeout of Ever Pujols, who hit number 576 and 577 career home runs earlier in that game. So yeah. I think that's it's all downhill from there. He hopes it's not, but it's hard to match that one. But, yeah, I think a good addition, and I've said before on the podcast, there's always that extra boost you get when one of your guys from the system, homegrown guy, comes up and is able to contribute like Tim Anderson has done.
I've been bringing Jordan Bastian. I always say Tribe Talk, but it's not called Tribe Talk. It just is our latest talk about the Tribe. So it wasn't
right.
No capitalization there. Just it's a Tribe Talk.
Thought it was the podcaster event.
It's the podcaster. I like that a lot. That is not exactly picked up steam on social media or anything, but maybe someday. All right, so let's talk about the first place Indians. First of all, give me the latest on Michael Brantley, obviously a big X factor for them here in the second half.
Yeah, Michael Brantley moved his rehab up to AA Akron, continues to make good progress. You know, as we've discussed a few times, you know, on the recent podcast, the optimism continues to be pretty genuine and getting close to doing back-to-back games. In fact, by the time some people are reading this, he might be in the process of doing back-to-back games. And really, that's going to be the next step. And then maybe after that, trying to get him into, you know, three in a row at the minor league level. You know, I think what they want to do, as we've mentioned kind of a few times, is, you know, make sure that when he comes back, he's ready to handle pretty much an everyday load. They don't want to get into that same situation like they were earlier this year, where it was a lot of starting and stopping and, you know, kind of still managing his playing time. I think they want to be a little more certain that he's capable of being the everyday guy that they need out there before they bring him back up. So I think you're going to see the minor league rehab assignment, you know, continue on until, you know, they're fully confident that he can come up and play every day and not need days off necessarily worked in intermittently.
Yeah, and they're in a better position than they were the first time around. Obviously, we're later in the year. In the second half, they've got, not to the point of comfort, but they've got a nice lead in the division, so they can certainly get Brantley back to full speed before they actually have him infiltrate the Major League roster. But obviously, Brantley's looming return has a big impact on this club when it comes to the trade deadline, and it seems like the conversation has certainly shifted from the conversation we were having for months about outfield help and what they might do there to probably the more glaring need is in the bullpen, certainly on the left-hand side. Tell me what you're hearing about the deadline at this moment. We're still a couple weeks away, but Indians obviously in a position with their farm system and in this deep relief market to do something there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think they have the ability, especially what they are in the standings, where if they want to add on a player that is making some salary, you know, as long as it's nothing just
exorbitant. They're going to be able to take it on. And I think the preference remains to target guys that are under control beyond just the remainder of the season. You know, I don't think they want to necessarily look at pure rental type guys. And obviously the biggest name that could potentially be on the market is Andrew Miller. And I would imagine the Indians, you know, kind of keep their toes in the water there as they get towards the deadline. If the Yankees reach that point where, you know, they want to potentially, you know, sell some of those guys that they have, depending on where they're on the standings. So I think that would be a name. If you think of someone like Will Smith, you know, another lefty, you know, that's a guy that would also probably be on the radar given where he is, you know, salary-wise and controllability-wise. So I do think bullpen is going to be the big need. We've seen kind of a revolving door with left-handed relief. You know, Brian Shaw in the setup role has had some sporadic lapses, but overall has still been pretty solid this year. And Cody Allen is the closer, and I don't think they're looking to sort of replace him at the back end. So I think you're looking more at like a left-handed type setup guy that could help out. So I think that's going to, like I said, continue to be the need. And if they do want to address a bat, they've got to weigh that against the fact that Brantley could be coming back here. So trying to find a way to fit another bat in. And you might be looking at third base, though. That's probably where Jose Ramirez would slide if Michael Brantley does come back and is healthy and able to perform. And, you know, catching now is obviously kind of glaring with Yan Gomes out. It was glaring when Yan Gomes was in there, I mean, given his offensive production. But they have Roberto Perez coming back, who the Indians feel could be a starting catcher for many teams. You know, he just happened to be behind Gomes on the depth chart. They like Perez. They like Chris Gemenez and what he's brought to the team, both in the clubhouse and kind of pairing with Trevor Bauer as his personal catcher. So, you know, they're going to kind of have to weigh all that, too. If they look to add a catcher, you know, do they really want to disrupt what they have in place and what's working with the pitching staff, which is really doing the heavy lifting here. So that's kind of the landscape as we head into the couple of weeks heading up to that deadline.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And as far as the catching is concerned, obviously, you know, Jonathan Lucroy of the Brewers is a big name in this market, but it's tough. And he's under very reasonable contractual control for next year. And that's a place where the Indians could conceivably upgrade their offense. But, you know, midseason, especially for a club built around its pitching, that's a big change to make midyear. And you're right, the pitchers like working with Gemenez and Perez in the past. So we'll see what he can deliver coming off the DL. Coming up to the big club. So you mentioned earlier Shaw, and one thing Terry Francona got criticized earlier in the year was, you know, continually sticking with Shaw in those high leverage spots. And lately that confidence in Shaw has been rewarded. So the new criticism, JB, is at first base where occasionally Carlos Santana sees the light of day and obviously made a couple of defensive gaffes over the weekend in Minnesota. But I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway so that everyone else can hear the answer. Why does Carlos Santana see any time at first base?
Because when Mike Napoli needs a day at DH, somebody's got to play the position. I think Mike Napoli is the superior first baseman. The Indians knew that when they signed him. They also knew he's missed lots of time with injury over the last few years. And he's basically, when he has been healthy, been used as a platoon player. So he's in a situation where not only is he being asked to handle a full season workload, he's being asked to do it as an everyday player. And he's done it well. You know, he's seen a ton of pitches. He's hitting home runs. He's found a home as the cleanup hitter, you know, and given a little more flexibility for them to move Santana in and out of the leadoff spot. You know, so Mike Napoli's brought a lot to this team. But as we get into the second half, he's going to be entering into sort of workload and at bat territory that he hasn't had in a while. So they want to guard against that and keep his legs fresh. And, you know, there were times earlier this year where Santana was playing first more often in a week or two stretch than Napoli was. And it was because Napoli was, you know, feeling it a little bit in his legs. So Francona needs to mix and match with that spot to keep Napoli as fresh as he can, especially when you're not only planning for the rest of July or August or September, when you're starting to map things out, looking ahead to potentially having the workload carry into October, you know, that's why you're going to see him DH here and there. And that's why you're going to see Santana in the field. And, you know, it's, yeah, there's been, you know, laps here and there, but think what those two are bringing as a duo offensively over the long course of a season is going to outweigh, you know, one or two bad games here and there for Santana on defense.
You mentioned Gomes going down with the injury, and that, of course, happened shortly after the Joe Boo ceremony, which made the rounds on Twitter and whatnot. So it just seems like that ceremony did not take. And it just not one more thing to go wrong in Yan Gomes' season. Jeez.
Yeah, when we were talking to Jimenez after Yan Gomes was injured, he just kind of was like, you know, not only could the guy catch a break, but I mean, just you could sense just how genuinely they felt for Yan Gomes. Yan Gomes is, I mean, as much as fans see the batting line, you know, and kind of cringe and, you know, maybe people wanted him not to be the starting catcher or the Indians to acquire a catcher, he's very much a part of the fiber of that clubhouse in terms of that leadership core, in terms of leading by example. And so, yeah, that ceremony and the sacrificial ritual was pretty silly, but it was his teammates kind of showing how much they have his back. And it was also kind of a very big example of how key Yan Gomes is to that team and to that group of players and, you know, what they think of him. So I think it was kind of it was funny. It was fun to watch. And then it was pretty unfortunate. Jimenez said they may have to take all the stuff back to Target and tell him it's cursed, you know, just throw it away. I mean, Yan Gomes was the guy that was on deck when the two-hour rain delay struck in the 11th inning the day before he got hurt. So it was like, it's Murphy's Law, just what can go wrong has gone wrong to the nth degree for this guy. And, you know, hopefully for the Indians' sake, the shoulder thing's not too serious and he can come back and, you know, kind of just wipe the slate clean on what's happened to this point this season, because he's got a Silver Slugger in his trophy case, so it's in there. You know, we've all seen it. You know, and he runs the pitching staff well. So hopefully for his sake, he can kind of just forget about this and maybe the Indians can kind of put the voodoo capes away for a while.
Beck, obviously the trade deadline is on the lips and in the minds of fans this time of year. The Tigers have been a team, you know, hovering around in that playoff chase all season, despite some rough stretches along the way and then some great stretches along the way. It's been a hard team to really, you know, get your hands around, but obviously very much in the playoff picture here at the, you know, early in the second half. But at the same time, over luxury tax, and I'm sure that's going to impact what they can do at this deadline. So what's the latest as far as the Tigers, what they might look for, what they can do, what is realistic for this club the next couple of weeks?
Well, they're at least doing their due diligence on scouting starting pitchers and getting a look at what the market's like. The problem they're going to run into, and I think they realize it too, is that there are so many teams in the market for pitching help up and down the pitching staff, whether it's starting or relieving. And with the way the playoff picture is right now, a lot of those teams have deeper farm systems than the Tigers, and a lot of them have more top prospects to deal and more appealing top prospects to deal than the Tigers do right now. So I think really this is one of those years where, you know, it's Alvila's first year as a GM, so we're still kind of learning what his tendencies might be. But it just strikes me as a type of year, kind of like 2011, where you saw them make a run at some of the top pitchers on the market. They couldn't match up that year with the Indians to try to get Ubaldo and then, like I remember, Drew Pomeranz might have been part of that deal. He was a highly touted prospect at that point. So what they did was they turned around and they were able to get a smaller deal done with the Mariners, packaging together a few prospects for a relatively young but inconsistent starter named Doug Fister, and the rest is history. This strikes me as that type of trade deadline, where they could get something done smaller but try to get a bigger impact out of it.
Yeah, that's what you look for this time of year. It doesn't have to be the blockbuster necessarily. And then, you know, one thing with the Tigers is they're not in the situation they were a year ago where, from the selling side, like even if they were to entertain that thought in the next couple of weeks, it's not like they're You know, it's not like they have a Jonas Cespedes on their roster, you know, a pending free agent superstar. So it certainly seems like a situation where, at worst, Beck, they'd probably just kind of go status quo and let it ride with this current roster.
Yeah, I mean, they could do smaller deals. You know, K-Rod could be up for free agency. I think he's got the option for next season. You know, that's somebody who might have some appeal to other teams, you know, whether it's teams looking for a closer or maybe for a veteran setup guy. Or maybe something like that. But you know, for people yelling, well, you know, it's time to sell everything and try to accelerate the rebuild process, it's nice to say in theory, you know, if things run really south. But even if they did, like, the contractual obligations attached to a lot of these players make them really difficult to trade. And if you could trade them, the contracts really prevent you from getting full value for them. You know, yeah, Justin Verlander is having a nice stretch here, and he's looked really good, but he's still on a contract for 2019, and he's got 10-5, right? So, you know, even if by some stretch of imagination you were to decide that, you know, this might be the time to try to deal him, he can basically leverage his way into getting his 2020 contract option picked up for, I think it's $22 million. And he's under contract for $28 million a year until then. Miguel Cabrera's in a similar boat. Ian Kinsler even has got some obligation coming his way, although it's not nearly as long term. So, you know, I think once they went all in the offseason to try to contend this year, they really ruled out a whole lot of maneuverability this summer.
It seems to me, Beck, that Daniel Norris could be, you know, maybe an X factor for this club in the rotation in the second half. He could be, you know, as big of an impact as any guy they'd reasonably or realistically be able to get in the trade market. What's the latest on Norris coming back from his injury?
Well, he's supposed to be making a rehab start Monday night for Triple H Toledo. If all goes well there, there's a chance they could try to accelerate the timetable on him and try to bring him back next weekend against the White Sox in Chicago. I know that would be a pretty good boost for them if they could slot him back in the rotation. And I guess, you know, maybe not have to give Anibal Sanchez any more starts, maybe move him back to the bullpen where he seems to be a little bit more effective. But a lot of it's going to depend on how he feels and on how his pitchers react. He says he feels really good after the oblique injury and that he feels like he can be a full go, but he's going to have to demonstrate on the mound. But yeah, I think you're right, where, you know, this could be one of those stretches where the biggest gains they have are internally just getting guys back from injury, both with Daniel Norris as well as with Jordan Zimmerman maybe down the line, and hopefully J.D. Martinez either at the end of this month or early in August.
Yeah, J.D., of course, on the shelf in the outfield. And Steven Moya was the guy who initially got those opportunities in right field. He was sent back down to AAA over the weekend, and now it's Tyler Collins getting his look out there. What do you make of that outfield shakeup, Beck?
It got to the point where, not even just in the field defensively, because I know a lot's been made of, and rightfully so, just his slowness and getting the ball, his tentativeness on some difficult plays. I think beyond that, if you look at his offensive numbers, while on the whole they didn't look too bad, he had fallen into a pretty deep slump here, really since the end of the previous homestand. So really for most of July, if not a little bit earlier than that, he'd been slumping. So it seemed to be building to where things were getting away from him. So they decided they couldn't really afford to wait for him to work his way through it. So they made the switch. It's a little bit surprising, and I think it cost them twofold, because on the one hand, you know, while Tyler Collins could be an effective bat, he's not necessarily or really nearly as intimidating of a bat as Moya can be when he's on. But I think beyond that, now I think we're back wondering again what type of prospect Steven Moya is going to be for these guys long term. Is this a guy that you can look at as being part of the Tigers outfield in 2 years when Justin Upton has an opt-out? Yusei Martinez's contract is up.